Council of Jewish Women. Today is the 11th of September. It's approximately 9:45. We're continuing with the third tape, First Side, interviewing Mr. Maurice Shapiro. And here we go. It's Mary Harrison with the National Council of Jewish Women's Oral History. All right. Maurice, there are several things that I'd like to go back to. First of all, you asked me the last time we were together to ask you about Dr. Rubinow, and I'd like to hold off Dr. Rubinow, and you asked me to ask about Mr. DeHaas. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to hold off on these right now. I didn't want you to feel that I was ignoring it. There were several things that I'd like to sort of catch up with and also tighten it up a little bit. I would like to have a kind of a short history of the Joint Distribution Committee. We have just...
Well, I'm not the one to give you a history of the Joint, because I am only familiar with it through the fact that my father worked for the Joint Distribution Committee. No, that should be... There probably are books about it too. But the interesting aspect to it was that of its widespread activities and its ability, the organization's ability, to work cooperatively with international organizations while dealing specifically with the problems that arose, for Jewish refugees. And for displaced persons at the end and right after World War II.
We talked for a few moments. You mentioned, you alluded to the flu epidemic of 1919. Is there any?
1918.
Or any other flu epidemic, or any other kind of epidemic that you were involved with. Is there any...
Obviously my involvement in 1918 epidemic was strictly as a baby.
Right.
But my father had to deal with it as a physician at the time. What did you want me to...
Well, whether you have any the flu epidemic was mentioned by you through your dad, talking about your father. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering whether you had any statistics about that time, or whether you had any specifics that you could tell us about. If not, then we'll just...
No, other than knowing, from history of epidemics, like a book by Winslow, is that it was a pandemic, probably one of... other than the Black Plague, probably one of the worst that existed in the world. It certainly was had tremendous impact in the United States and in Europe, but in the United States, and we know about it. And you can ask practically any family who had people at that time, and there was either one or two or three victims in the family. So from a point of view of its mass effect, it had nothing in United States history, to my knowledge, that can compare.
And could you tell us what pandemic means, just for the record?
Well, pandemic means an epidemic which is really just worldwide or very extensive. Pan meaning everywhere.
Yes, okay. Dr. Bluestone, is there any more that you can tell us about Dr. Bluestone?
No, not I only remember the name, and I would have to go through my father's memoirs to get more about it. But that he was an administrator and a physician in the first and second Hadassah medical mission to Palestine, and a rather well-regarded individual.
You mentioned Mr. Cantor and the Panama Canal. Could you?
Mr. Cantor was an engineer, and one an American engineer, and one of the first first in a breed of what are called sanitary engineers, which is an engineering branch that evolved out of civil engineering. Sanitary, the name that was stuck with it, with the profession, excuse me, with this branch of engineering for a long time until relatively recently, was because they dealt primarily with water supply, water resources, and wastewater collection and disposal. And it evolved into a separate branch in civil engineering around the turn of the century and a little beyond that. And he was one who worked in that field, both in the Panama Canal and then in Palestine.
We started out in our first tape mentioning Camp Stewart and then naturally the Iraq situation. And since we are recording a tape for 20 years from now, I think that if you could give me a short rundown of the Iraq War. I guess it started, what, July 9th?
No, August 2nd.
August 2nd, excuse me, I have it written down, absolutely.
No, August 2nd was the day that Saddam Hussein's armies invaded Kuwait.
And he was the president of
Saddam Hussein is the president of Iraq, who arrived at the presidency some 20 years before this time in a coup, which... Well, the coup, the origin of this is, I'm not sure about this, whether he was the coup that overthrew the king, Faisal, or that he came after the overthrow of the king. And I really don't remember that.
You know what? I don't either. It was in Time magazine just recently.
Well, it should be. Well,
maybe I can. We can go.
Yeah, we can get that.
Okay.
I should make some notes.
Okay.
That's all
right. I don't know why his brother appears in my head. Okay.
Whose brother?
Hussein.
Hussein? I don't know his brother at all.
Okay. Then we'll get back on the year, the coup and the exact dates, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Let's continue on just with what happened in Iraq. I think that to clarify that he annexed Kuwait.
Well, he is.
That's what he's saying. He's doing.
That's what he's saying. He's doing. He, after promising, well, after beginning a saber rattling situation. Once he arrived at a ceasefire with Iran after an eight-year war, in which was started by Saddam Hussein in 1982, in order to gain more territory and gain what he claimed was Iraq's right to a waterway called the Shatt, Arab, which is a waterway and the border between Iraq and Iran, and other landmass. The war, after 8 years, arrived at a stalemate, but with some of the land occupied by Iraq, but still feeling that he has not won enough and wanting the tremendous oil wealth of Kuwait, he first started saber rattling. And when that was understood by other Arabs, in particular President Mubarak of Egypt, who went to Iraq to forestall any additional or any new warlike acts on the part of Saddam Hussein, and returned to Egypt saying to the world, and this is Mubarak returning to him, saying to the world that Mr. Hussein promised him not to attack Kuwait on August 2nd, or really on August 1st, and just before that, the end of July, he was amassing troops on the border with Kuwait, and on August 2nd moved into Kuwait and displaced the existing sheikhdom there, and the ruling family, and has been there since then till today.
Okay. And there also, I think the consensus also is that since the 8-year war with Iran, he also needed funding, needed money desperately because the cost of the war.
Well, yes, and that invading and occupying Kuwait with, I presume, I don't know if anybody knows, his calculation that nobody would stand up to him on this thing, that it would be a fait accompli, and that neither the Arabs nor the international community would stand up to him, that therefore he could just take it over and have it without any further ado. And it remains to be seen whether that kind of calculation was correct or incorrect.
But at the moment, the international community is one.
At the moment, the international community is arrayed against him as no international community was arrayed against an invader in the past.
Exactly, okay.
And the hope would be is that that would stand up.
You mentioned Hiram Bush, who was your mentor at Camp Stewart.
He was not my mentor, he was my boss.
Okay.
He was a physician, a U.S. Public Health Service regular corps physician, a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, who was assigned to run the Liberty County Health Department, which was established as a health department because of the development of Camp Stewart.
Also, one thing that I misunderstood you, and Gabby mentioned this, when you traded jobs with Alberto Walsh.
Walks.
How do you spell that?
W-A-C-H-S.
Oh, okay. But I gave you the wrong spelling, Gabby.
Walks.
W-A-C-H-S. Okay. You exchanged the identical jobs, or what job?
Well, it can't be identical because the job that Professor Walks had was as the professor of sanitary engineering at the Technion, that's T-E-C-H-N-I-O-N, the Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa, was as director of the sanitary engineering program and the sanitary engineering laboratories in the civil engineering department, while my position was as professor of sanitary engineering, and then the name was changed to environmental health engineering in the Graduate School of Public Health. So although the functions were similar, although not identical, because Professor Walks was involved with educating engineers exclusively, not exclusively, but nearly exclusively. And my position was to educate both engineers and non-engineers who were students in the Graduate School of Public Health, namely physicians, nurses, hospital administrators, statisticians, epidemiologists, so on.
Okay. Gabby, since you raised this question, is there, do you feel that that's your answer?
Oh, no, I'm comfortable.
You're comfortable.
And okay. I had
okay. The other thing that I don't think we talked about was your sabbatical in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was an interesting happenstance that occurred.
What year?
This is 2 years for one year sabbatical and 1 year leave of absence, which occurred in the calendar years 1973 and 1974. We have had a visit from an Australian physician. And I'm blocking on his name right now. I had it on tip of my tongue, but
okay.
I'll get it back. If I don't, Anne will have it. Who was a member of the health department, a staff member of the health department of Victoria, an Australian state, in which the city of Melbourne is located. He spent a week with us because his interests, he was a public health physician, but his interests were in environmental health primarily. And learned about Pittsburgh, learned about our air pollution work in the county, and about other aspects of environmental health in the city, the renaissance of the city, and our academic and research activities at the School of Public Health. After he left, I practically forgot about him, but then subsequent to his being here about a year, he sent me a letter with a description of a position for which they were trying to recruit, a position in Victoria for which the Victorian government was trying to recruit an individual, you know, on a worldwide basis. The position was to be the founding director of what was called the Western Port Bay Environmental Study. Now, remember that this was in 1972, which was just 2 years after the first Earth Day. So it was in the infancy of the worldwide environmental program or environmental movement. The job was to direct this study, which was to be a jointly funded study by the government of Victoria, the state of Victoria, and industry. Industry being steel and oil and gas. Oil and gas had recently been found in an area which is called Bass Strait. Bass Strait is the water, the sea area between the mainland of Australia and the island of Tasmania, which is to the south of Victoria. The island of Tasmania being another state in Australia. And the drilling had brought pipelines and refineries to Victoria. Western Port Bay is a bay that lies to the east of what's called Port Phillip Bay, upon which Melbourne is located, with a peninsula called Mornington Peninsula stretching between Port Phillip Bay and Western Port Bay, with 1.5 million people sitting on a watershed that feeds into Port Phillip Bay. That's a highly densely populated area with a lot of commerce and industry and recreation. And only some 50 miles to the east of that, across the Mornington Peninsula, sat Westernport Bay, although the first bay to be discovered by Dr. Bass, was really relatively unsettled. A 50-mile shoreline with only some 40,000 people located versus 1.5 million.
When you mention people, how many of those people are the Aborigines of Australia?
Oh, practically none.
Okay.
None. Victoria has very few of the Aboriginals left. Well, I'm trying to synopsize it. Westernport Bay had a deep channel, natural channel, which would allow super tankers to come in, and flat land and access to labor, which was moving east from Melbourne as development occurred in the hinterland to Westernport Bay. And although the notion of developing that area for an industrial development had been announced or had been thought of many years before, in the 30s already, prior to World War II, it had never occurred. One of the premiers of Australia before had thought that they would develop Westernport Bay as the Ruhr of the Antipodes. In other words, really industrialized. You could have rail lines, you can have water transport, flat land to build industry, no problem of construction and so on. Water, which is a real problem in Australia all the time, available coming in from the north, from the mountains and so on. Well, when it really came to the fore after World War II in the 50s and the 60s, and the first beginnings of this industrial development had occurred, namely a rolling mill as first part of a integrated steel mill and a fertilizer plant and a gas fractionation plant, the people who were living there and used it for recreation, had summer homes there, began to feel frightened that this pristine area would be really raped. So they started a movement going, and it ended up with this notion that before the development occurred, they would have this study to undertake to find out what could be done, what should be done, what should not be done.
So it was more of a prevention thing rather than...
Well, yes, and to remember that this really was unheard of in the past.
Exactly.
This was never done in the past. And they were looking for a director for this thing. They had already had an advisory committee, and in the Ministry of Conservation of Victoria, they had a section dealing with it, but it had not been ongoing yet, and they were going to start in January of 1973. What they were asking me for was to send out this notice to colleagues who may be interested in a position. And that I did that, and then thought about it myself.
You were already in Australia.
No.
You were in...
No, I was in Pittsburgh.
You were in Pittsburgh.
This was in
okay.
Pittsburgh. And then I started thinking. I was getting ready for my second time for a sabbatical was coming up. And the thought occurred to me, even though this was not strictly an environmental health, would be interesting kind of change to undertake. And so I broached it to the family and submitted my application. Then I was told that the chairman of the advisory committee or chairman of the operating committee, the deputy director of the Ministry of Conservation, was going to come to the States to interview various candidates. It just so happened that I was overseas at the time, and when the notice came that he wanted to see me here, and somehow the letter telling him that I was not here and when I would return was sent to him by surface mail to Australia.
How long did that take?
And when he arrived in Pittsburgh and arrived here on the same day that I arrived back at New York, but could not get back to Pittsburgh because I arrived in New York after the last plane left from New York to Pittsburgh and had to spend the night there. He was rather upset and left for Ann Arbor, Michigan that same night instead of waiting.
How did you two get together?
Well, that's interesting. He just died recently, and I wrote his wife about it. When I came back the next day and called him on the phone in Ann Arbor, thought occurred to me, well, you know, Detroit is not that far. Well, I could drive up and see him, but he was flying out to Seattle, Washington the next day on a Sunday. I ride home on a Saturday morning. And so I did the next thing. I said, okay, if you tell me when you'll be at the Detroit airport, I'll fly in from Pittsburgh. And that's what I did. And we had a two-hour meeting at the Detroit airport. And to make a long story short, I was the one selected then to be this foundation director of the Western Port Bay Study.
Okay, you did that. That was your sabbatical.
Sabbatical.
And then you mentioned a year.
I took, because sabbatical is either 6 months or 1 year. So the next year, because this was a two-year assignment, I took as a leave of absence.
Okay. One other thing I wanted to clear up, and I'm not sure that you can, but I might be repeating myself, but we talked about the silk stocking regiment
mm-hmm.
in New York. Was that part of the Army War Show, or was it not? Or didn't we ever establish that?
Well, the Silk Stocking Regiment was the 7th Regiment of New York City, which was a reserve. I'm not sure it was a National Guard. I think it was just a reserve regiment. The reason it was called Silk Stocking is because it was, the members of this regiment were rather well-off New Yorkers. In the 7th Regiment Armory in New York is always known at all kinds of shows and at balls and things like that. And they were an anti-aircraft regiment. So that when Camp Stuart was established as really the first, I don't know military history, but I would presume, if not the first, at least maybe one of the first anti-aircraft training camps in the country after World War I, they were the ones who were the first to arrive at Camp Stuart.
All right. Did you want to talk about Dr. Rubenow and Mr. DeHaas, or is that something?
No, not yet. I'll
okay.
have to. I did not, since we were away, I did not.
Okay.
I should make some notes.
I have that marked down. I'm going to go now.
Excuse me just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a question, I'm going to, because the kids want it, I'm going to reproduce a Xerox, my father's memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any desire, I could, give a copy if you want to put them.
We would love it. We would love it. Okay, that would be wonderful.
Wait, one thing, I'm going to put this tape. I think it's going to be overstated.
Because then all of these
yeah.
questions, and it has more of the kind of information. I was just reading some more this morning about his North African experience.
All right, I think that would be, we would love it.
Yeah.
I would like to go back a little bit to your family life, where your children were all born.
Well, our firstborn, Carla, was born in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
Okay, and the second one?
The second one, Mark, was born in Berkeley, California.
Okay.
Actually, in Oakland, California, mm-hmm. to be exact, because he was born at the Kaiser Permanente Hospital.
Okay. And the third child?
The third child, Deborah, was born in Pittsburgh, and the other three after Deborah were all born in Pittsburgh.
Okay. So we have two out of Pittsburgh, actually.
Pardon?
Two out of, right. Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about your adolescence. Such a wonderful time of life.
To some, in your family. To some, it's a terrible
time. Well, that's why I'm being a little sarcastic. Recreation, just in your community. And
yeah, well, remember that my upbringing had a duality to it. One was Palestine, one was the United States, and really maybe three, because we spent 1 year.